KCOS's only In El Paso series recently launched its fifth season. The series, which celebrates stories that, as its title implies, are only found in El Paso, is a collaboration between PBS Digital Studios and KCOS, El Paso's local PBS station. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak. The current season launched online in late February, with episodes launching weekly for the next 10 weeks. My guests today are Emily Martin-Loya, general manager of KCOS, and Cassius Casillas, a filmmaker featured on season 5 of Only in El Paso. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so let's start. Emily, what was the original idea behind Only in El Paso?
Well, so we're in our fifth season, so it's been a little over 5 years. As, you know, sometimes you don't stay on exactly the same schedule you planned. So when I first started at KCOS, it was one of the first projects that we jumped into. We were not yet working with local filmmakers in any way, and I just felt like there was a gap in our community in that. And we were fortunate to find that PBS Digital Studios was launching some seed funding to help work with filmmakers or to produce in-house your own digital series. And we went with work with filmmakers approach. And because there's so much talent in our community that doesn't often get a chance to be featured, and I think we're a lot further along 5 years now than we were then. So we partnered with Destination El Paso, got a pilot done, and got rolling. And we've been doing 10 episodes a year ever since.
And how has the series been received in the year since its launch?
Well, it's been received really warmly. Folks love to hear local stories about people, places, experiences you can find only on our border. And it's fun that we almost always have a celebration at the end of the season. So it's fun to see folks who've been in the films come out, who made the films, come together and get to enjoy each other. And then, of course, all the comments online is really fun to moderate and enjoy.
So full disclosure, for the past two seasons, I've been part of the selecting committee for these films. Can you discuss kind of what you look for when proposals from filmmakers come in?
Yeah, so we want to make sure that the story has some uniquely El Paso angle. Also, that they have the chops to make a really interesting story. So there isn't a lot of documentary work happening in our community. There is some, but this is a mini-doc series. So we want to make sure they have some experience telling stories, not just doing scripted stories. So those are the main things. And we want to make sure they didn't repeat like a topic we've already done in the past so that they've looked at past work.
So filmmakers receive some funding to produce these films. Where does the funding for Only in El Paso come from?
So this season and last season, the funding has come from MCAD as our major funder, and then also funding from El Paso Electric and Destination El Paso. And that covers all of our filmmaker stipends, which really, they're still doing it out of the love. It's a $750 stipend to produce these episodes, and lots of them are putting in $5,000 worth of work and all of that. But it's a great platform, too, and a really cool community to be a part of. And we're fortunate to have continued to fund it over the years and be well-received by sponsors as well.
So one of the things that I kind of love about the series is that each episode looks completely different, feels different. There's no episode feels exactly the same. Was it a conscious choice by KCOS to not enforce a visual standard on the filmmakers?
Yeah, we realized that there's too many different styles and different folks in our community. And honestly, it takes a lot more coaching to do it. But as well as like our border community is very deeply varied, and we wanted to have a unique style and let people show their unique style. So we didn't want like a, this is the format and it's the first minute's this, the second minute's this, the third minute's this, like make sure you have this establishing shot. So, you know, some of them seem kind of out in left field, but it's really fun to see what each person comes up with. So it was somewhat conscious, but also a little bit just practicality.
So Cassius, moving over to you, as a filmmaker, opportunities like this, especially sort of sustained ones over the years, are rare for filmmakers locally. In your view, what does this opportunity mean to establish and burgeoning filmmakers like yourself?
I think it's one of the biggest things. I've done some personal documentary work in the past, and it was really nice to do and really fun, and I got to get together my small crew. But one of the biggest things I always had problems with was not being able to pay them as much as I'd like to, because I really enjoyed their work. In this case, I couldn't use my same cinematographer, but the last time I loved him, and like all of his work, he does regular portrait photography. It's just really nice to see that like filmmakers' work are taken seriously. Seriously enough to be like, here's a little money. Like we want to see, like not only do we want to see your art and showcase it and like not just your own platform, which is normally YouTube or Vimeo. So it's nice to have that platform and then also be like, yeah, and you can also pay some of your people and you can pay yourself. And that's like incredible to me.
One of the things about your film, which centers on the local comedy scene, is that you do a very deep dive into this industry, which, I mean, we're aware of the stand-up comedy scene here, but I don't think I was aware of the people who are behind it or how long it's been around. So can you talk about what drew you to that narrative?
There's actually a cut part that's set on the cutting room floor where one of the comedians, and you'll see him in there, Nico, he stops me in the middle of the whole conversation. He's like, I don't even know why I'm here. Like, why did you have me on here? Like, I don't know why you're doing this. I think I'd forgotten to tell him that it was like the PBS thing. And I just told him I was doing a documentary on comedians. And he's like, I don't understand why you want, like, why are you asking my opinion on these things? And I explained to him that, like, I really respect both him and then just the comedians that are working. One of my first photography jobs was with a company called Laughter Hours. And through that, I started seeing all the different comedians and how much work they would put in, how consistently. And then I'd go back in my world. I saw all the work that they put in, and all I see is this flyer that I have to help share, and that's it. But, like, there's so much more work that goes into it, and they love it. In fact, I was freaking out about a couple days before I had to turn it in because I had no ending. The ending was the hardest part for me. I had this constant downward spiral of, like, oh, yeah, bombing on stage is no good, and being a comedian, you have to do all these things, and you miss out parties, and you miss out on all this different stuff, and you can't hang out with friends or family as much as you'd like to. And it kept going down this downward spiral. And I was like, there's got to be something to this. It can't just be like this depressing, episode. And like, all right, well, that's what comedians are. Bye. So I ended up getting back with Anthony Austin Brown. It's one of the last black and white scenes where he talks about not being, like, he never felt that he mattered to a lot of people and that this was the first thing that made him matter. And I was like, there it is. That's the crux of the whole thing, is that it's like it's people who are beaten down and make jokes out of it, and the jokes help them make them feel like they're worth something in their lives.
So when you were filming your documentary, you probably worked with a team of collaborators. What was that process like?
I love working with the team. But with this one, a lot of it was myself. I hate being the person that's like, oh, written, directed, da-da-da-da-da, like all these different credits. That's why it's like maybe 4 credits in the whole thing, and all of them are different names. But I always had to be sure to get them all local. Our creative director, Frank, told us, like, suggested very early on, it's like, if you put music on there, make sure it's local. And I was like, okay, I got to find a local with music. I got to find local teams and everything. But a lot of it was just talking with comedians and then getting their opinions on things and then getting, like, pre-interview things, getting behind the scenes. It helped that I was saying, like, oh, I'm doing documentary work, and I've worked with Jibs, one of the other comedians. And everyone's like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. And so they started just going on and on and on. A lot of the work, honestly, was in the editing room. I tried to get as much footage as I could. I actually interviewed some out-of-town comics, which unfortunately I could get cut. And, yeah, a lot of the process just ended up being me finding the story, if that makes sense.
So, I mean, for you in the editing process, how many different versions of scenes did you end up constructing? Because most movies come together during that process, and they can have 1,000 different forms.
Yeah. I talked about earlier about how I had to like find my ending. Mm-hmm. But there were a couple versions. One of them started like around 10 minutes, where it was talking about how, and I think this is really important, which it killed me to cut, but it was El Paso not being able to, I don't want to say respect comedians, but show up two different shows and then be respectful when they get to their shows. Like some of the showcases I would film, people would arrive and it wouldn't be a lot of people. Some of them were quiet and some of them weren't. Or like, let's say I was at a bar, everyone was loud, no one listened to the comics, and it turned into the comics having to work the crowd and work it all together. And that was one version I wanted in there because I thought it was a really important, I still think it's really important to have that in there. I'm gonna find a way to push that. I had to cut different versions. A lot of it started out the same. Like, a lot of the intro kind of started out the same with starting out like, oh, I started in El Paso doing this. The whole Jacob Esparza's backyard thing. A lot of the conscious choice was trying to create, like, this arc of this is how I started, and this is where I'm at now. And, like, I've gone through some troubles, but here I am now. Actually, what's interesting is my thesis for starting this changed about halfway through in the editing process. My original thesis was just like, yeah, I'm showcasing open mic culture and comedians and just a general idea. But then as I started cutting it, and I already had all my interviews and everything, as I cut it, I was like, no, this is about the struggle of comedians. This is about like an artistic struggle of finding an audience, performing, practicing, and then dealing with like the politics therein of. And so the thesis kind of changed. I guess that kind of helps your answer, is that there was a definite switch midway into the editing process. But I would say about like three versions kind of existed at some point, I guess, to give you like an actual numerical answer.
So when you were editing the film to only in El Paso standards, did you find that the time constraints placed on you by the station opened up different ways to be creative in telling a story?
Yes. My biggest thing is I love constraints. And I'm going to go a little bit on a tangent, but I think that's one of the most important things that El Paso filmmakers need. There is a lot of filmmakers out there, and there are a lot of videos being produced. I've worked with a couple production companies, different people, and I respect all of them. I respect everyone's hustle for creating film. But I think when you have no constraints, the product just becomes this very muddled mess, and you have all these different ideas and themes and all everything going on, and it just doesn't correlate or just doesn't make any sense. And you've got this now 20-minute quote-unquote short that you want people to watch, but it's 20 minutes out of their time when Netflix has some like really good shows that are 20 minutes long, or maybe less or more impactful. And I think with the constraints, what the constraints helped me do was think, okay, instead of this being like a 15-hour-long thing that I want it to be, and like be a podcast that's just filmed, it became, no, you have to figure out what your story's about, what everyone's talking about, how they're saying it, what are you going to do to showcase, like what are you going to visually show that's important about what they're saying. There were a bunch of major factors that led into the decisions that I made in the editing room because of the constraints that were put in place. I'll be honest, I still feel like I pushed those constraints because my video was like around 5 minutes. And I was like, because they started out like, yeah, it's got to be 3 to 5 minutes. And then like after that, the language became, so about 3 minutes. 3 minutes, and I was like, oh no, like I can't do this in 3 minutes. And again, like I talked about how there was parts I wanted to keep in place because I thought it was very important, had to get cut at the final, like the final day. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I can't have it in here because it doesn't work. It makes the video too long, and the ending won't matter as much if I don't take this out. And that was like such, those decisions are so difficult to make, but I had to make them because it's constraints and it's important for the arts to have those kind of, I guess, creative constraints. Because a lot of good stuff comes out of like diamond in the rough. I always believe that everything's made out of like, all diamonds are made out of the rough. I believe like all films, like a lot of really good productions are diamonds in the rough. Things that are done, maybe not last minute, but a lot of big decisions come into play because of whatever constraints are put on them. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think people work best under pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have pretty tight timelines too, you know, because we select folks. And this year, selection happened in the fall, like late fall, winter. Mm-hmm. And then they knew and signed contracts in January. And then, you know, we staggered their launch times and thus their rough draft and final draft deadlines. But some of them just had 3 or 4 weeks to crank it out. But even if they had 10 weeks, you know, they might not start on it until 2 weeks before then anyway. We're only paying them, you know, a $750 stipend. So it's not like we're expecting them to work from the day they sign the contract. But it's cool to see folks respond to that.
Which is funny about that, because the second I found out I was selected and I just needed to get started, contract started, I was like, great. Now I can start working on the better thesis and start working on the whole thing. The second I found out, I looked on Facebook and I found it. There was an out-of-town comedian coming into town for one show, and it was that night. And I was like, I kind of wanted to get started on that later. I wanted to have my thesis in place before I actually started doing these. So I just went to the show, and I like that was, I think, a good portion of all the comedy bits are at that show. That I was just like, I got to get this done. Batteries charge, like you know, get a cruddy mic, whatever, or just use the onboard mic on the camera. Like we just got to go and get this film stuff so that we can use it later. Because she's only in town for like these next couple days. Mm-hmm. So talking about that, like, and then the actual interview process didn't start until like February for me.
So there are, Cassius's film is one of 10 total. And how many have launched so far? I think we have...
we should be four in because they launch on Friday.
That's
so
right.
This is we've just launched four, so slightly less than halfway through the season. And then at the end of the season, you know, it's a weekly release. We'll have, after the 10 have launched in May, we'll have a celebration at Alamo Drafthouse. They're a great partner with us. So it's another feeling as a filmmaker to see your film on the big screen, mm-hmm. not on the small screen. And and we're excited to be able to do that with them and a chance to bring your family and friends out to do it as well. So that's how we kind of conclude the season. But what I love is that all this content is really fun no matter when you check it out. Like, we'll have folks commenting on Facebook or YouTube, like, from episodes in season one. Mm-hmm. Like, they just start to spike up. And that's kind of a cool thing about evergreen content, like what's created in these unique stories that we tell.
Oh, yeah. What's that line from The Social Network? The internet isn't written in pencil, it's written in ink. And I just I just love that all these films, these wonderful El Paso stories, just get to live there forever. We've been discussing the fifth season of Only in El Paso, a web series celebrating all things EP. My guests today were KCOS General Manager Emily Martin-Loya and filmmaker Cassius Casillas, whose film is part of this season's run. On Film's producer and engineer is Seth Van Meter. An archive of past programs can be found at ktep.org. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak. Thank you for joining me for On Film.